Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. This week's episode of Talk Nerdy is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. Get boutique quality, classically crafted eyewear, including sunglasses, at revolutionary prices. And for a free home try-on of five stylish frames of your choice, plus free three-day shipping, go to warbyparker.com/nerdy. That's warbyparker.com/nerdy. I also want to thank a handful of folks who supported the podcast this week by going to patreon.com/talknerdy. We will start here with Phil T-Bear and Timothy Glover. I also want to thank Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. And just a random sampling, let's go ahead and thank, Rob Barcy, maybe Pat Douglas, Matt Dillahunty, Anthony Roberts, Len Weaver, Mike Tripico, Matt Pedelty, and let's pick one more. Thank you to, I'm trying to pick people whose names I can pronounce. You know what? Let's try one I can't pronounce. Edward Kennedy. That wasn't too hard. We got to pick another one. Ah, here's one. Opinionated Peanut. Thank you. You're awesome. I also want to thank those who visited the portal at carasantamaria.com and clicked through to PayPal this week. I want to thank Amanda Munster, Rob Miller, and James Mitchell. Thank you guys so very much. All right, guys, this week I have a very special guest. He is a friend who I've known to, or I've grown to know a bit more through meeting him from a lot of my friends at Caltech and JPL, many of whom I've actually had on the show before, like Crystal Dilworth, Tegan Wall, Holly Bender, and a bunch of other cool people. But this week I had a chance to speak with physicist and all-around brilliant guy, Dr. Casey Hanmer. Well, Casey, thank you for coming to my incredibly hot, my sweltering apartment studio to have a chat with me today.
It's totally okay.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I don't understand. It's because you've only been here for like 10 minutes so far.
Okay, I'm going to start sweating probably about the same time as you're asking difficult questions. So
then you won't even know why.
I won't know why.
My clothes are drenched. I've been here all day, and last night we had to sleep in this. It was horrible.
I can't imagine what that must be like coming from the Arctic country of Australia.
I know, and I'm from Texas, but isn't it funny? So you were just saying off air that this is the fifth anniversary of you coming to America.
That's right. 5 years ago, I kind of left everyone I knew and loved behind in Australia and came out here and knew no one. I was going to start grad school, which is always a recipe for happiness and joy and and see what happened. And here I am.
And here you are, and you've graduated.
Yep.
You are now doctor.
I'm doctor. Don't ask me about your rash, but
but you've also probably experienced what I definitely experienced coming here from Texas, which is that I adapted to LA weather so quickly that now I can't handle extreme weather.
Yesterday it rained and I just walked around in it and I was like, cool.
That is cool.
Bonus hygiene.
I didn't see it raining.
Oh.
Did it only rain in Pasadena?
Yeah, maybe just around me. I don't know.
That sucks. I wish it would have been gross though, because it was like 90 degrees outside yesterday.
Yeah, I don't mind the rain actually. I travel quite a bit and it always takes a couple of hours or days to acclimate and then I'm fine.
To the rain?
Well, any kind of weather, any kind of weather. I mean, I was doing some mountaineering way back in the day and my toes used to get cold because my shoes are too small. And so I thought the best approach is to wear sandals in winter and my feet will get used to it. And then when I go mountaineering, it'll be fine. And they were. But now it always disturbs people when they see me running around in snow in sandals and they're like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, well, how long have you got?
Wow. You still do that?
Yes. Well, I don't actually own closed-toed shoes anymore. So I don't have much of a choice if it snows.
That's funny. So you just walked in your sandals and I was like, good choice because it's so hot in here. And
they're my everyday sandals.
Yeah, you were like, this is just what I wear. But what would you do then if you actually did go to New York in the winter? You'd have to buy shoes.
I would probably have to go to a shoe shop.
Yeah.
Luckily, I know a couple of people, some mutual friends who would be more than happy to help me there.
That's true. Probably Crystal would be my number one choice to take
you shoe shopping. Crystal would certainly be capable of taking anyone shoe shopping, I think.
I wonder if people remember Crystal at this point from listening. I've referenced Crystal a lot on the podcast because she's like one of my best friends, but she was on like Many moons ago.
Yeah, like 50 episodes ago, maybe?
Probably. Oh, my God. That's like a year ago.
Yeah.
That's weird. But now you're on, and I'm excited to talk to you about all things grad school, about all things Hyperloop, if we're going to get into that, if you want to get into that.
Yeah, I can talk a bit about that.
I would love to talk about that. So let's talk first about what, you know, you came here 5 years ago.
Yeah.
What did you come here to learn?
So I finished my undergraduacy in Australia. And I took 10 months off because the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere academic years are out of phase. And then I came here and I switched fields because I wanted to always work in gravity, but there wasn't really many opportunities in Australia to work in gravity. So I came here to work in gravity and I very quickly found that I was vastly out of my depth doing quantum field theory. So I switched to classical theory of gravity, which is just so much easier. And the really neat thing about that is that about the same time as I finished my PhD, Christopher Nolan and Kip Thorne's movie Interstellar came out, which you haven't seen it. You could probably go and like press pause and watch it and then the rest of the podcast will make sense. And it's wonderful because they took all these equations that my colleagues mainly have been working with for years and turned them into amazing visual effects, which makes them much more accessible to me and my colleagues and also my mom. And other people who like to know what's going on. So I guess I came out here and I found that there are actually real life people getting paid real money, sort of, to work on understanding black holes in a classical sense and the way they interact. And I guess I can talk about that for a bit if you're interested in hearing. Okay, cool. Kara's nodding at me, nodding and smiling and possibly backing away. The really neat thing about black holes is that for a long time we kind of theorized about them. We didn't really have any good evidence that they existed, but now we have all kinds of evidence they exist, which is super cool. And for those of you who may have tuned in late, a black hole is simply an object that is so dense that even light cannot escape from it. I mean, it turns out that humans can't escape from Earth without rockets because we can't jump upwards at 7 miles a second. But if we could, then we would be able to escape. But if Earth was, you know, the size of a golf ball or something, but the same mass, then it doesn't matter how fast you jump up, even light can't get out.
So the idea is that the number that we refer to as the escape velocity?
Yeah, exactly.
And so in a black hole, the escape velocity is zero.
It's the speed of light.
Or it's the speed of light.
Which is approximately zero in certain gauges.
There you go.
It's the speed of light, which is kind of cool. And all kinds of really fancy stuff happen because light gets bent by black holes. And if you saw Interstellar, then you'll know what I mean. That's not really what we study. What we study is we studied Einstein's theory of relativity, which predicts black holes and explains them. But we're almost completely certain that it's not 100% correct. This is not me saying, oh my God, Einstein is wrong. That's a bit of a cliche. But we know it has to have some additional complicating factors because it's not a quantum theory and it should be a quantum theory. But it's very difficult to tell what might be wrong because it's very difficult to test gravity. Gravity is really weak. It takes as much matter as the entire Earth to generate enough gravity. And even then, we can still overcome it temporarily with chemicals, like chemical energy locally. If you jump over a cat or something, you know, the electrons in your legs are beating the entire Earth for a few seconds.
So wait, I want to back you up for a second because
okay,
you just covered a lot of stuff in that one sentence. So the one thing you said was that it's not quantum, but it should be. And what you mean is that Einstein's theory of gravity doesn't account for any quantum mechanics.
That's right.
But it actually probably needs to in order for us to fully understand gravity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we don't really have a quantum theory of gravity
yet. We don't.
Okay.
But we'd like one. And I know some of your guests have previously talked about this and they work at it from the quantum angle. And one of the things that we are trying to test is gravity in the strong field regime. So if you've got a theory and you want to break it, which is what all good scientists like to do, you want to test it in the most difficult circumstances possible. And the way that you do that is you take, in terms of gravity, the strongest gravity you can get is around a black hole. So if you've got a black hole and you can observe it, then you can suddenly start doing tests on gravity. Of course, it's difficult to observe black holes because light doesn't escape. You know, we've got some distant black holes that are visible using X-rays and gamma rays and stuff, quasars and so on, but it's not really what we need. It turns out the perfect way to see what's going on with a black hole is with the gravitational wave.
Yes.
If you haven't already, I can recommend some guests to talk about gravitational waves.
I had Chiara Mingarelli on the show. So she talked about gravitational waves, but she very specifically talked about using these pulsar arrays in order to use them. So, but this is not what you do?
I'm kind of getting into what I do. So gotcha. In grad school, you don't tend to solve the whole problem.
Exactly. You tend to actually focus on a really specific angle of a problem.
Exactly.
And so Kiara's angle specifically, and she talked about it quite a bit on the show, was looking at these pulsar arrays to try and understand black holes through the way that they lens gravity.
Yeah. So you can use the pulsar as a clock a long way away and then basically compare that to a clock on Earth and... cross fingers, you can detect gravitational waves with very low frequencies corresponding to black holes, say the mass of hundreds of thousands, millions, hundreds of millions of suns, which would be quite large. If they were in the middle of our solar system, we'd also be inside them here on Earth, where we are 8 light minutes away from the sun. Whereas the black holes that I would be studying for my work, it doesn't really matter. You can always scale the mass. But the ones that we think of when we think of LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, are stellar mass black holes that weigh about as much as our sun, and they're a couple of miles across. So they're less than the distance I drove this evening from one side to the other. And but they're super dense. And what happens sometimes, you get two of them in the same area, and they'll orbit each other.
Gotcha.
And as they orbit each other, they'll be distorting the fabric of space and time. And I thought of a really cool analogy for this, which is imagine like two super sweet dancers with really tiny stilettos on a dance floor. I don't care what the gender is. It doesn't really matter for this purpose, but they're wearing stilettos and the stilettos are like deforming the dance floor and making it shake. And then we're out at the edge of the dance floor staying the hell away because, well, we just have our reasons, I guess. But we can feel the dance floor shaking. And from that, we're going to try and determine what's going on.
And you can think about how incredibly minuscule these shakes are and how little information they're actually going to give us or how much we really have to understand the shakes.
Well, they're going to give us a kind of information that we can get no other way. So even if it's really difficult to detect, and spoiler alert, it is, but that's not my area. These waves have passed through the Earth and they squeeze it by like the width of an atom, like the width of a proton, which is really small.
It's like almost the smallest.
Yeah, you can't get much smaller than the width of a proton. It's like a factor of 10 to the 20, so like one with 20 zeros after it. If that was my bank account right now, I'd be very happy if it wasn't in Zimbabwean dollars.
which it is.
Yes.
Unfortunately.
It seemed like a good strategic investment at the time. Yeah, Bitcoins are doing that. Long story.
This is the bank account of a recent PhD graduate.
Yeah, well, now I got a real job, so just
you
wait.
You do. And we'll talk about that. But so you mentioned LIGO. Tell me about that, because you mentioned it in passing.
Okay, so LIGO is this, again, it's not something I work on directly, and I would hate to steal the thunder of future guests, but it's...
But it definitely, we need to know the reference to know
okay,
what
yeah,
you
absolutely.
Do.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. There's actually two of them currently, and plus some various versions of them made by other collaborations in other parts of the world. Imagine a L-shaped room. Each arm of the L is 2.5 miles long. Each one contains a metal tube, and inside the tube there is nothing. It's a vacuum. It's actually the biggest vacuum in the universe that we know of. There's less material in these tubes than there is in interstellar space.
Wow.
That's how good the vacuum is. And then at each end of the tube is a big glass mirror. Each mirror weighs about 100 pounds, suspended by glass fibers, and then 6 additional levels of seismic isolation, passive and active. So that, for instance, a thunderstorm in Africa, waves crashing on the shore from a storm in Florida, a truck driving by on a nearby interstate, a plane flying over and so on, won't disturb the mirror. These are the sort of noise sources they discovered and were like, oh. And they spent like a long time, basically since I was first learning math, figuring out all these details. And as of now, like literally today, I think they're starting the first science run of advanced LIGO, which means that by the time my postdoc finishes at the end of October, there's a good chance that the first ever detection of gravitational waves will have happened. At least even odds that you know, the first detection of gravitational waves by LIGO, direct detection of gravitational waves ever, certainly a Nobel Prize material, not for me, for someone vastly more advanced, will occur at the same moment that I leave the field forever.
And so specifically, they're looking at these like perturbations like you described?
Yes, LIGO is designed to measure what's called the metric, which is basically a way of measuring distances between things very, very precisely. And with a collection of mirrors inside, they put 500 kilowatts of laser power between these mirrors, and then each mirror wiggles by some insanely tiny amount. We're talking like each mirror moving by way less than the width of the atoms that it's made of. And then the beams of light coming out the other end interfere with each other and mostly cancel out. But if they don't cancel out, that means the length of the tubes has changed very slightly. And that it allows you to detect if a gravitational wave has occurred once you apply enough statistical magic to it.
And this is the idea that this gravitational wave has like passed across the physical space of where these tubes are.
Yeah, this is somewhat difficult to describe without a diagram. Mm-hmm.
I like to envision, but I don't know if it's a good way to envision it. But if you've ever seen these like these movies where they try and illustrate sound waves.
Yeah, okay, so we can build ourselves up that way. Sound wave, if you imagine you've got air particles between me and the microphone, and they vibrate back and forth, and the direction that they are moving on the bulk in order to transmit sound waves is in the same direction as the direction the sound is going. Mm-hmm. Whereas with light, the oscillations of the electromagnetic field are at right angles to the direction that the light wave is going.
Gotcha.
And gravitational waves are one step beyond that further in that the oscillations you can envision as you know, a circle that's being squeezed into an ellipse slightly back and forth. And the direction of the light propagating is perpendicular to the plane of that disc. And so if Kara and I sitting at this desk had a gravitational wave pass between us coming from the center of the Earth straight up into space, then if this was a very strong gravitational wave, such as if we were right next to said black holes, then we may observe us moving further apart and then closer together and then further apart and closer together at the same time as the ends of the table, which is, you know, at one side to my left and right, are moving also further apart and closer together, but out of phase. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense. So
we're kind of, I feel like I've seen something that does this move before. I'm doing it with my hands. You guys can't see it at all.
It's amazing.
It's
this
move,
right? If you could
see it,
you'd be so happy right now.
It's like squeezing a rubber band in one direction and then it's snapping back in the opposite.
And then squeezing back in the other direction. Yeah. And if you take like the plastic ring off the top of a bottle, you know, the ones that get in penguins and lizards and stuff and make
them
sad.
Yes.
Yeah, but if you were to, like, before you cut that with scissors, before throwing it away, like a moderately socially responsible individual, you were to like squeeze it a couple of ways and you'd be like, I can science.
I love it. Okay, so this is the way that the gravitational waves kind of bend space.
Exactly. Yeah, they bend. That's what they do. They bend space and time, which is kind of weird to think about. Again, think about Interstellar. In the original version of Interstellar, the original script, they actually talked about gravitational waves, but they obviously took it out at the end because it wasn't in immediate service of the plot.
Yeah. Was Interstellar based on a book? Or was
no.
it just a film script?
It was the movie that you see, I think, is the seventh draft of the of the original scriptment that was developed by Kip Thorne and Linda Obst. And originally, Spielberg had a couple of goes at it, and I've seen a copy of that script. It's floating around the internet, and it would have been a very different film, I think.
Yeah. Linda Obst also did Contact.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. She's like super cool science producer and really fond of like strong female characters, which I've always been a fan of when you look at her kind of repertoire. She's done a lot of amazing stuff.
So she should totally come on this show.
I know. I should try and get her.
Yeah.
We'll see. And of course, Kip Thorne is a physicist, you know, a premier physicist at Caltech, who's also best friends with Stephen Hawking, famously.
Yeah, he's retired now. He spends his time in Hollywood making movies. But
I guess that's true. He's
He does float around the department from time to time.
Kip Thorne does not like me.
He does not like you?
He doesn't like me personally.
That's right.
Yeah, because I went to a party that he didn't personally invite me to, but a friend of his invited me to.
And you said mean things about Stephen.
I said very nice things about Stephen.
This is true. I've seen the article, and I think that, you know,
I thought it was very
with enough
nice.
Water under the bridge, all things may be possible.
I hope so. And you know what? We did actually communicate back and forth. It was Stephen Hawking's birthday party. I went. It was very cool. It's probably one of the most cool things I've ever done, is go to Stephen Hawking's birthday party. Like, I can't believe I'm saying that out loud right now. That's crazy.
I would totally have said that. The only thing I ever did for Stephen's birthday was jump out of a hedge once and sing him happy birthday.
See, that's cool too.
Yeah.
And he was there when you sang it to him?
Yeah,
did
he comes
like
to Caltech for like a month every year. And
but did he like sit and listen, or did he just like wheel right past you?
Well, he did stand. He doesn't wheel himself anymore. He's wheeled by one of his assistants.
So you were like,
he didn't
you better
wave.
Not move him.
He didn't wave. I couldn't say that there was a great deal of body language response. Mm. But I heard later that he was really tickled by it. So
that's good.
Nice.
That's really nice. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he does. So he visits a lot, and he was spending time with Kip Thorne, and they had a nice party. And I wrote a piece about how amazing it was, but also about how sad it was to see, you know, the ravages of ALS. And I think that, you know, I think it would be totally different if I had written this piece after Theory of Everything came out. I think that was one of those very specific things where, for a very long time, this amazing man who has amazing friends who love him dearly, 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 and kind of protect him from seeming human and fragile, after this movie came out, which actually very much humanized him in many, many ways. I think that's probably the cat's more out of the bag. I mean, the cat's always been out of the bag, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've never spent much time with Stephen personally. Mm-hmm. My impression is that, like all physicists, he is a person.
He is a person.
And I think your article was very humanizing in a way that I actually quite liked, but, you know...
Oh, thanks. But I think the thing
opinions can vary, and that's okay, because exactly. People have different opinions, and they exist.
The thing that's very hard about spending time with somebody with ALS who's in advanced stages who you don't know personally is that you get no feedback from them. You try to, but it's all, you know, letters on a computer screen, and you have to make sense of what you think they mean, because like you said, there is no body language at all.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Literally none. So you have to really just kind of guess. Does this guy want me to leave? Is he trying to be nice? Is he being, you know, poetic because he thinks it's funny? Is this just how he talks? Like you have no idea. It could be like the ultimate ruse. You could totally act like somebody that you're not, which is kind of cool. But anyway.
Maybe he puts on different personas when he talks to different people and it's a joke.
I bet you he does. That seems like something he would do.
He does have quite a sense of humor.
Yeah. So Kip Thorne, who... I assume you know.
Yeah, I know him. Actually, this is one of the greatest achievements of mine at Caltech was that for 1 year I was the Uchibachi, which is a
what? Is that a word?
It's actual word in Hungarian. I think it means brother, uncle, or something. But I'm sure someone will email in and correct me. it's a position within the department that's very ceremonial, and outwardly it looks like a bad deal because it's your job to stock the fridge with soda. And organize parties and spank people who mess up the fridge and stuff like that. But is also it's a very long story tradition of physicists who've selected each other over the years, over 20 years or so, to be this position. And in this position, one of the nicest things is you get to organize the parties at Kip's place at the end of every spring and fall, and make sure the barbecue's working and keep people from being too noisy after 10 and organize the dance tracks and stuff. So I've hung out at Kip's place a couple of times and it's a really very nice house. I walk through and I'm like, oh yeah, tenured professor. Oh yeah. Like this
and
is what I should be.
Like framed letters from Einstein on the wall, like crazy stuff in his house.
Yeah. There's a original Feynman, print. Actually, one of the most exciting things I saw there was the first time I went, that I remember at least, I just finished doing the Physics 136 class at Caltech, which is based on a textbook which is finally being published by Kip Thorne and someone whose name escapes me right now. Mm. And all the drafts of this book were there on one of his tables, and it took up about 8 square meters, which is like 80 square feet in American. And that's, I was just like, wow, like this is how a textbook, one of the best textbooks I've ever read, gets made. This is how the sausage gets made. It was quite mind-blowing. You know?
And you said it was Physics 136. What class would that be?
Applications of classical physics.
Sure.
So everything in physics is not quantum. It starts off with tensors, which is like mathematical formalism, and it goes through fluid dynamics and talks about relativity, special and general relativity, and it talks about elasticity. It talks about a whole bunch of other really cool things in the middle that I don't remember right now. But one of the really cool things is that a lot of these... problems that you look at, a lot of these areas can be illustrated with examples from LIGO. And a lot of the problems refer to problems that were solved in LIGO. So like you get a question, you solve that question, and your solution is a summary of someone's PhD who did it 15 years ago, which is, it's a really cool, way of doing physics if you're privileged enough to be at the place where it actually all went down for the first time.
And where it makes sense to you.
Well, yeah, that helps if it makes sense to you.
But there is this kind of understanding that you get as you become more, I guess, versed in your scientific discipline, where you realize that all your discipline is a conglomeration of the history of that discipline. It's that you get to know what you know now because so many people before you figured all this other stuff out. And if you were trying to do it from scratch, obviously you'd be...
Takes a while.
Yeah, you'd be like hanging out with Kepler. You'd be before that. You'd be like questioning everything.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is that you get to learn from all of the discoveries that everybody has made. And I think that when you learn science with a strong emphasis on the history and the systems of science, instead of just having all these facts and figures in your mind, you start to understand why you need to know the things that you need to know and how this like beautiful story of science is told, which unfortunately in many lower level science courses, I don't think is the way that it's taught.
Well, I would be the last person to suggest that science is universally taught well. for all people. And one of the nice ways of teaching science is to bring in some historical context. That's very difficult to do in a comprehensive manner, obviously, because 99% of science is finding ways that don't work, which is something you learn in grad school, obviously.
Yeah, because you constantly fail.
Because you're the one doing it. and then if you're very, very lucky, like extraordinarily lucky, in 20 years, everything you did in your PhD will be a paragraph in the textbook somewhere.
Mm-hmm. And that's like the luckiest ones.
That's the luckiest ones. You'll be a paragraph somewhere. And the reason for that, especially with physics and what really appeals to me about physics, is that over time, it's the complete opposite to law. There's like emphasis on the importance of building a physically intuitive narrative that bounces down all the previous knowledge into a much more compact notation, much more compact set of ideas. You're an excellent physicist if you can take an idea, a whole bunch of different ideas that currently occupy a lot of space in textbooks, and explain them with one underlying principle that meshes the whole lot together, and then also leads to additional physical insights and predictions and stuff that you can test. And so one of the really cool things is if you ever open up a physics textbook from 150 years ago, it'll have chapters and chapters and chapters devoted to stuff that's now covered in like one sidebar box, because back then it wasn't, you know, they didn't understand necessarily but very deeply how all these things fit together. But nowadays, essentially everything that you see in everyday life is understood very, very well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like the observations were there, and sometimes they probably weren't quite correct, but they were pretty strong observations going back hundreds of years. But the mechanism by which, you know, you observe them,
a lot of the subtlety and finer detail, has been worked out since.
So before we get back to kind of the train that we were on,
what's the rush?
I know. What actual degree do you have? Is it just physics?
Yeah, it's a doctor of philosophy
in physics.
Theoretical physics, yeah.
In theoretical physics. Yeah.
So my work is actually in computational physics. I didn't work on LIGO directly. I didn't work on the quantum aspect of physics directly, of gravitational physics. I basically sat in front of a computer and wrote code that very, very gradually became less buggy and more functional.
Well, I've always wondered.
Quite a pleasant day.
Oh, damn it. Go ahead.
Sorry, go on. I said right up to the present day.
No. Oh, you did. I'm sorry. I thought I interrupted you very rudely. I kind of did.
Try
I'm sorry.
Again.
Okay. I've always just wondered, and because I want to get like deeper into what you did, but silly question, but like a school like Caltech, for example, which is...
There's so many of those.
It's a physics school. I'm not belittling the other, you know, departments. There are a
physics
lot of
amazing... Physics is very strong at Caltech.
Physics
yeah.
is incredibly strong at Caltech. It has a rich history of it, and it's got many, many faculty and many labs dedicated to it. I always wondered how nuanced and how specific the degrees that you get there are.
It's a very interesting one. And sometimes, you know, I try and visualize it. Caltech is a very small school. Not all of your listeners may appreciate that. It's a very highly ranked school, but necessarily it has to focus in very specific areas. And that actually applies all the way down to the weeds. Mm-hmm. So you know, you'll have a professor, you'll have like say six professors in one department, say that'd be a very big department. And it may be that like over the course of one PhD, those six professors work in five different areas between them. And they tend to move around quite a bit. They mix and match. And so at that time, if they're doing well, Caltech will be a world leader in those areas. But you know, maybe there's 100 other related areas they're not working in, and you may as well, unless you're doing that work yourself, then there's not much going on in that area. But that's one of the huge privileges at Caltech, in addition to the colleagues and the people I've met through there, and, you know, just incredible company of really smart people, is that you really are on the bleeding edge when stuff like the Bicep 2 result came down, or maybe didn't, as the case may be.
Yeah.
You know, like I walk down the corridor five doors and there's someone who spent 6 months at the pole tightening bolts to make this thing go. And that's the sort of immediacy that I didn't experience directly in my undergraduate. I mean, Sydney University is a great school, and the physics school is very strong in areas that some areas I even worked in, but not necessarily in the specifics of this gravitational stuff that I've worked on the last 5 years.
But when you have kind of a preeminent school where really, I think the administration tries to pick the best of the best of the best, you're going to have lots of discoveries that are taking place there. And even if they're not happening specifically at that university, you know, if it's something that happened at Harvard or it's something that happened at Stanford, one of your professors probably worked on it in some way.
Yeah, they'll come visit each other and hang out.
Yeah, or there'll be a discovery that's made and it then like kind of validates something that somebody there had been working on.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, remember how we were saying just a second ago, like 99% of science is doing it the wrong way. You know, a new discovery will come through, and one example that comes to mind is the firewalls paradox stuff. And, you know, there are a bunch of people at Caltech have worked on this area for decades, including mm-hmm. Stephen Hawking and John Preskill and so on. And, you know, like, it's probably fair to say that between them, they'd got 99% of the way there. But they, you know, they had never really put it together or understood it fully. So when something like this comes in, it's not like all the people are sitting around smart but have no idea what's happened. They then kind of talk about it over coffee and suddenly, you know, with this last missing piece of information, everyone there knows exactly what's going on. I don't really know what's going on. It's not my area, but but you can almost feel the excitement bouncing off the walls and you know, circling the turtles in the pond and stuff like that.
But it's interesting that it's not your area. It's interesting that, like, to somebody who sits on the outside and goes, like, physics is a thing. And yes. Then it's like, even specifically black hole physics, but I'm not looking at this aspect of black hole physics.
Well, if gauge-free spectral Cauchy characteristic extraction of gravitational waves is your thing, I'm your guy.
Those were some words. I heard them.
That's my thesis title. Google
Wait,
it.
One more time.
I'll have to say it in the right order again. Gauge-free spectral Cauchy characteristic extraction of gravitational waves in numerical general relativity.
I think he said Cauchy.
Cauchy, yeah.
I did hear that.
It's a Swiss word.
I like it.
What does that even mean? Well, I guess we can talk about it, but...
Actually, now's a good time to say, when we come right back, we're going to learn all about what the word Cauchy means and all the other words that he said too, which I can't repeat.
Nor can I have to look them up.
All right, guys, so sit tight. We'll be right back. I want to thank Warby Parker for supporting this episode of Talk Nerdy. Warby Parker makes high-quality, stylish frames for prescription glasses and sunglasses. And also, guys, they're crazy inexpensive. They start at $95 for completes. That's the frame and the polycarbonate lens with anti-reflective coating. Just bananas. Compare that to similar quality boutique brand frames that sell for $300, $500. I mean, glasses get pricey. I should know. I have like 8 pairs. Warby Parker also has this really cool free home try-on program. You go to their website, you choose 5 pairs of frames, and they send them to you so that you can try them on at home. You can take pictures in them. You can ask your friends about them and ultimately decide which ones you like best. I did it recently, and I have the 5 frames. I have pictures of all of them, and I'm trying to decide between all 5. So keep an eye out tomorrow. I'm going to tweet Facebook and Instagram a picture, and I want you guys to let me know what you like most. The one that you like the best, I will go ahead and get. So it's between – this may mean nothing to you unless you're on the website right now, which you should be on. Go to the website so you can look at these awesome styles. It's between Rowan and Graphite Fog, Holcomb and Pearl Tortoise, Vern in Beach Glass, Upton in Sea Smoke Tortoise, and Hardy in Pacific. Those are the different styles and colors. So yeah, guys, go to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and check out the photo that I posted. Tell me your vote. But you know what? Probably my favorite thing, even cooler than home try-on, my favorite thing about Warby Parker is their one-for-one model. For every pair of glasses that you purchase, Warby Parker sends a pair to someone in need in partnership with nonprofits like Vision Spring. Amazing. You can be helping out and get stylish frames also. So I don't know what you're waiting for. You can try Warby Parker out all for yourself. You can see how good you look in their frames. If you go to www.warbyparker.com/nerdy, you'll get free 3-day shipping on your final frame selection. So you'll do the home try on, you'll get them shipped to you for free, you'll ship them back, and then you'll get free 3-day shipping on your final selection. Guys, don't wait. Go to www.warbyparker.com/nerdy today. That's www.warbyparker.com/nerdy. Thanks, Warby Parker. We are back with Dr. Casey Hanmer.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we were about to talk about all of those words.
All of those words. All right. So for my PhD, I was entrusted with a project, which I discovered 2 years in. People had been attempting off and on for 20 years with no success.
Oh, yeah, that seems like a great thing to jump into.
Yeah, exactly. Try this, Casey. It shouldn't take you too long. And so basically, to give you some background, in order to detect the gravitational waves using LIGO, we also need to have a pretty good guess mm-hmm. for what they might look like. And one of my friends describes this as a cocktail party effect. It's much easier to recognize your friend yelling over the cocktail than some random person because you know mm-hmm. what they sound like. And we do that with giant computers. We have a couple of big computers on campus because, you know, people fund science. This is not crowdfunding. This is your tax dollars at work. And also like independent rich foundations. Shout out to them as well.
That's like crowdfunding without having a say in it, really.
It's involuntary like a Kickstarter crowdfunding.
With a gun to your head.
Well, I'm not quite the same. I don't really believe that taxation is the same as slavery. But
it is not.
But I think if we're going to spend money on things, especially like billions of dollars on science projects like LIGO and Curiosity and the LHC and so on, that's wonderful. I do think, you know, defense is important, but we spend roughly 1,000 times more money on defense related projects than the specific flagship projects. So
we could easily double, triple, quadruple our science budget if yeah. we. I mean, this is a
with
whole
like
other
the
conversation.
Air conditioning budget from Afghanistan or something.
Exactly. Yeah, with like the Bolt budget. Like
the
just,
Bolt budget. Bolts are important.
Yeah, but let's just maybe we change our Bolt dealer and then all of a sudden everything's different. But
all
yeah,
of a sudden
I mean,
we can make more space robots. Yeah.
We can make more space robots, which we will get to. That's very important. But it's true. So you know, we do fund science as citizens, but we don't fund it nearly to the extent that we should. But scientists with good track records tend to get the federal grant money a little bit better. So you are, you know, both lucky and
I was very lucky to parachute into a department that had an excellent track record and also a large existing code base mm-hmm. and a huge amount of existing expertise, which was just enough to help me muddle through the problem. And this is the problem. We simulate black holes colliding with each other. Now, I'm going to describe this because it's super cool. two black holes, their event horizon, which is the thing you think of as the edge of the black hole, just a region in space, not particularly special, except that if you go inside it, you're never coming out, orbiting each other. Each event horizon is a couple of miles wide. They're separated by, say, 20 to 100 miles, something like that. They're orbiting at speeds approaching the speed of light. And so at those distances, the frequencies involved are similar to the frequencies that I speak with. And in a few minutes, I'll actually sing for you what the sound of two black holes colliding is.
I love it.
So if you were listening on LIGO and you got a very good signal-to-noise ratio, this is what you might hear. And as they approach each other, the event horizons actually pinch off a little bit like an elephant snout. And the two elephant snouts, you know, one for each black hole, reach through space and time and then eventually touch. And then the whole black hole merges together.
Like a barrel of monkeys.
Exactly like a barrel of monkeys. Yeah. And that shape is you know, really cool. And they spin around and they wobble and they ring down. And then it's turned into one big angry black hole that's just sitting there and eating things.
But still not that big, really, right?
Yeah, a couple of miles. I mean, like, it's...
It's crazy. Like, you're talking about something that could happen, like, in a small state.
Oh, it could happen in your backyard, practically. I mean, like the sort of distances involved are smaller than the LA Basin.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And the volume in which you simulate these in our computers, the computers are very large, but they're not infinite, is similar to the volume of the moon. So, like, about the same size as the United States.
Wow.
So you've got these black holes in the very middle, and then you've got all this empty space around them, which you're simulating the really angry gravitational waves, and then you've got the edge. Mm-hmm. And the problem is, again, if we go back to the dance floor analogy, you've got two people dancing in the middle of the dance floor, making the dance floor shake up and down. And the dance floor is made of, this is the analogy I was thinking of earlier, and I was like, ha, so clever. The dance floor is made of little, let's say, grid squares, like a parquet floor or like tiles or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you're standing at the edge, and you're trying to determine the gravitational wave, but the dancers are also like making the tiles wobble back and forth. Mm-hmm. And you don't really know like how much of the wave is due to you going up and down, like the wave, the dance floor bouncing up and down, or the parquet or the tiles is kind of wobbling back and forth. And that's just a consequence of the fact that when we simulate these things inside computers, we have to pick the coordinate system, which is essentially like the intersections of the tiles, very carefully, or else the black holes will eat the coordinate system and the simulation will die. You laugh, but this was like a problem for 30 years in
That's
the field.
Insane.
Fortunately, before I was born.
So because you're basically developing code that is simulating, not sucking. I learned this. Black holes don't suck.
Yes.
They don't physically suck. They don't actually pull matter away from where it already is. They're just so incredibly dense that light can't escape.
No more than the Earth does or the sun. Yeah.
Exactly. But so you're actually, it's because you're actually coding a simulation of something that will actually eat its own code.
It'll eat its own coordinate system.
Okay, what is the coordinate system?
The coordinate system is like a grid. Yeah. If you think that you do the simulation on, like you specify, for example, the amount of gravity at every point on the grid, and then you press go, and then what happens is the entire grid falls into the black hole, and you're left scratching your head, being like, "What just happened?"
So it's like the scaffolding.
Yeah, think of like the scaffolding.
It's like a horrible hellhole that opens.
So this comes under the banner of numerical problems, which is 99% grad student problems.
It's like a little worse than Y2K.
Yeah. That's what eats your code, and then you have to start again. So my problem was basically finding a way of taking those gravitational waves from the edge of the simulation, which is, remember before, is like the distance from here to Atlanta away from the black holes, which is not a safe distance for the record. If black holes are merging that far away, take cover. And then simulating a lot of intervening empty space, such as the distances you'd expect between Earth and, or our detectors rather, and these black holes, which might be another galaxy, you know, like a really, really long way away.
So what are you trying to get to, like outside of the event horizon?
Like far enough away that the waves stop interacting with themselves.
I see.
Okay. Because when they're really angry and really high amplitude, they can interact with each other a bit like, I'm trying to think of an example, a bit like sound waves do in a room that's full of lots of like confetti or something like that. You can hear this rustling sound as you get distortion, things like that. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, remove this gauge effect, which is the effect due to, you don't know how much of the gravitational wave is due to the wave itself or how much is due to the coordinates wobbling around. Basically I took the existing equations to do this, found some mistakes in them, fixed those mistakes. I don't know if I found all the other mistakes, probably, hopefully. And then put that in a computer and pressed go and it didn't work. And then tried again and again for like 5 years. And then they're like, okay, you have a PhD, goodbye.
Did it ever work?
Yeah, totally did.
Oh, okay. And you skipped that part in your summary.
Yeah, it worked. It worked. It worked really well. The spectral part, using the existing spectral infrastructure of the code that we use. Spectral just means using the fast Fourier transform a lot.
The what?
The fast Fourier transform. Some people will understand that. If you don't worry.
Okay.
The code is just super fast, which is really nice. So I wrote, like, let's face it, not exactly optimal code, because step one, get your code to work. Step two, optimize. Mm-hmm. And it was like 200 times faster than the existing code, which is a huge step up, but also probably reflects the fact the existing code was written in the 90s.
Gotcha.
And we had much more advanced infrastructure now. So
now people will actually be using your dissertation to then optimize and try and find any existing bugs and also try and understand, as a springboard for understanding this more.
Yeah, so what's happening right now, actually, and I've only got like a couple more weeks of this fake postdoc I'm in, but they're taking my dissertation code and they're basically bolting it on the outside of the existing code, so when you press play now, not only will the black holes not eat the coordinate system, you'll also not have to get heaps of data out. You'll just get like a little bit of data out and it will be just the data you want, which is the waveform that comes out of the black holes.
And so all the noise is taken care of.
The numerical problems are taken care of. Yeah. I've solved all this problem all by myself. No, not really.
Is this open source code? Or is it something where you have to pay like hundreds of thousands of dollars just to press play?
It's not, you don't have to pay to play. But you'd probably have to like know the right person to get access to our Git repository. And then they'd be like, so what are you going to do with it? It's not the sort of code that's useful for ripping off CDs or making computer games go or whatever.
As
I found
out
during code tests with Google.
Gotcha. And you need access to basically like supercomputers worth of data in order to do this.
Actually, all my code ran on my own workstation. So, because that's how good it was. No, I just didn't know how to write parallel code. So I had to run on my workstation. But if you've got access to a cluster or an Amazon Web instance and you want to be, shout out, if you're like a super good coder and you want to collaborate with people who are simulating black holes, send us an email and we can run on your Amazon instance and give you an acknowledgement in our papers or something. You know, we're totally up for collaborations of people with really big computers.
Isn't that interesting too? Because that's like a legitimate thing that you can do now. Mm. Is that there are people out there who are really good at this stuff who know nothing about physics. They have big computers and they're good at coding, but they don't really know anything about black holes.
Yeah. I mean, we know enough about coding to kind of get ourselves into trouble, which is good.
No, I don't mean you. I mean, there are people out there.
People out there. No, there's actually people out there who have physics degrees, but who decided, oh, you know what would be really cool? Sleeping on a giant pile of money. Hello, Wall Street. And but maybe they're thinking, you know, wouldn't it be cool if in my copious free time I actually did something for love? That's fine as well. So, and the collaboration that I work with in actually has branches at Cornell and also in Canada. So that was kind of my choice of postdocs, freezing New York or freezing Canada or Los Angeles.
Or stay here.
Yeah. So I decided to stay here and leave academia, actually.
So you're one of a few lucky people whose postdoc was continuing your graduate work.
Yeah, that was more of a deal I cut with my PI, which was like, during candidacy, you did not make my code being usable by other people an explicit condition of graduation, and probably you want that. So how about paying me more money and I'll make it happen?
Sure. So I'll stay after I graduate. I'll figure out how to do this, and then I'm getting the hell out of here.
And also because I'm foreign, I'm on what's called APT, which for Americans tuning in, don't worry about it. It's a nightmare. It's just mine and all the other foreigners, but does mean that I can't be unemployed for a long period of time.
Yeah.
So it's really helpful, and schools often do this where they'll hire you for a few more months just as a bridge to help you find an actual job and allow you to like wind up your account and pay off your loans and whatever else, pay off your bursa bill and kind of just tighten up loose ends.
I like that it's your visa bill.
Sorry?
Your visa bill. I like it.
I don't understand.
Just your accent. It's funny to me.
Oh, yeah, my accent is hilarious. So actually last week I was at Burning Man with a bunch of other people in an a cappella choir.
No, you were.
Yeah, I was. We were running around singing Baby It's Dusty Outside in perfect six-part harmony and blowing people's minds.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it was...
Were you all sober?
I was.
You were?
Yes.
Were the other a cappella singers
mostly
sober? Yeah, it'd be kind of hard to do that if you're too trashed. You could probably...
These people are very, very practiced. So
yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's true. Sort of like, you know, singing. You do it a lot.
Autopilot.
You rehearse a lot. That's autopilot, a cappella autopilot.
Yeah, so this temperature in here is quite fine.
You're right. You were just a Burning Man.
Yeah, that was really hot.
I had a lot of friends who were just... I did a whole episode where I talked to my friend Rachel Porter about Burning Man. She's a photographer. We talked a little bit about photography, and then we talked a lot about
Burning Man.
Like, Burning Man.
No photos.
Yeah, she actually one time at Burning Man... There's some famous photographer who takes pictures of naked people. I don't know if you've heard of this guy, but like not individual naked people. He takes like hundreds of naked people.
Well, that'd be the place. Yeah.
And lays them out in like weird
things.
Oh,
yeah.
Then takes his aerial
photographs. Yeah, I saw one on like a glacier or something.
Yeah. So she actually did that when she was, I think, at Burning Man.
Oh, cool.
Which was fun for her. Anyway, random. So wait, what were we talking about? You were at Burning Man? Why were we talking about that? Oh, because you were singing.
I was singing. I'm not sure why. Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot to sing for you The Sound of Black Holes Colliding.
Yes, please.
So I will. One second. Ooh.
Okay.
That's it.
It's kind of anticlimactic.
Yeah, you might think there'd be a huge explosion at the end, but here's the crazy thing. These black holes are orbiting each other. They've approached the speed of sound. They're getting so close that most of the gravitational waves that they're emitting are actually being swallowed by the black hole itself.
Gotcha.
And as they merge, they eat the last bit. So you don't actually hear it. Oop. Yeah, it just goes out with a whimper.
Yeah.
They swallow their own screams. Which is really trippy.
Is the sound of black holes colliding, like, is it congruent? Is that the word? To the kind of light waves of black holes colliding? Like if you looked at a visual sort of footprint of a black hole?
Well, the sound that I'm describing, it doesn't come from the black hole in sound.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in the form of gravitational waves.
That's the sound.
But if you
of
played them through a speaker, that's what they'd sound like without shifting the frequency. Like these things are the size, like miles across, and they're moving around each other so fast. They're doing hundreds of orbits a second, which is kind of mind-blowing.
But that's not the only signature that you can collect from two black holes colliding is a gravitational wave, right? You can look at different rays that come out of them.
Yeah, it's thought that maybe they'll emit gamma rays or something. We don't know for sure yet.
Oh, we've never measured that. I see.
Often they're obscured behind big piles of gas because black holes are often in very dense regions of a galaxy in the middle of globular clusters in the center of galaxies and sometimes a really, really long way away. But the gravitational waves themselves come straight through without any problems. So if we can detect them at all, we think we'll be able to detect them to a very large distance.
Yeah. So, but we may never know what the sound of the light, I should say, quote unquote light or electromagnetic spectrum of two black holes colliding would sound like.
Well, not unless we're bats. I mean, like optical frequency is like 10 to the 13 hertz, so that's really high pitched.
We could transpose it.
It or something. Yeah. I mean, we will know for sure because, you know, we're building ever larger telescopes. I mean, like the James Webb Space Telescope's going up soon, hopefully. And that thing just blows my mind.
No, it's beautiful.
Lockheed is the primary contractor, and they're like, don't worry, it's like the top five most complicated telescope deployments we've done in space.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first one that's looking up.
Yeah. It'll be fascinating. When did Hubble get retired?
It's still going.
It is?
Yeah.
I thought it was retired.
No.
Are they retiring it when they send up James Webb, or is it still going to be going?
I thought there
was some sort of a connection between James Webb going up and Hubble being SADS.
There was some discussion recently that you know, Hubble will no longer be funded once James Webb is working, which makes sense from a funding point of view.
Yeah, okay. But
I think it's quite likely that until Hubble suffers a catastrophic failure, which will probably occur in the not too distant future, that someone will find money to keep working.
Is Hubble super happy right now, or is it kind of like blind in one eye?
It's only got one eye.
okay, well, there you go.
Hubble is pretty functional. There's a number of other space telescopes out there which are actually perfectly functional. They're also in the process of getting kind of shut down from lack of funding, like Spitzer Space Telescope. Mm-hmm. But Hubble is very long in the tooth. It was launched in 1994 or something. Yeah. And so it's more than 20 years old. And all its guts have been replaced a couple of times now, I think. I think Johns Grunsfeld was the astronaut who did the last Hubble servicing mission, which is pretty cool.
That is cool.
Yeah. And it's Space Shuttle.
Hubble's really kind of nostalgic, I think, for a lot of us, you know, a lot of people in our generation, because they're like most of the pictures that we know and love of space came from Hubble, like the most recognizable photos.
It's just done amazing things for understanding. It's very important to realize, you know, like NASA gets something, what, half a penny on the dollar or something in terms of tax. And Hubble is only a small part of NASA's budget. And yet, you know, think of the legacy in terms of the way humans think about their place in space that we've learned from looking through Hubble.
No, definitely.
I want one like that in my backyard.
Yeah, it'd be really expensive. You're going to have to go into
Wall Street
I think.
Or something. Yeah.
Speaking of, you were saying, I mean, you've mentioned now a few times that you're not going to stay in academia. You're finishing up your postdoc and that's it.
I'm finishing up and I'm leaving. I'm not saying I'll never come back, but it kind of became obvious to me that I could stay working in this same field that I've been in, which is a very interesting field, but one that I've kind of, I feel like I've got out of my system. The thing, I came to California and suddenly you discover that people down the road are working on launching CubeSats into space to look at things and solve real problems. It's, you know, everyday kind of things. And this is something that I wasn't all that exposed to, probably from ignorance and being young. And also, you know, Australian manufacturing sector is very, very small. But, you know, I just like really wanted to get involved in actual problems that were happening now. And my kind of number one choice would have been to work at JPL just up the road and work on space robots involved in exploring Mars and Enceladus and the other icy moons and all kinds of cool stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So not just because a lot of my friends work there and do these really cool things.
You'd get to keep the same apartment.
I could live in the same area. Yeah. I could stay in the same flying club. You know, I didn't have to change my phone number.
Is it something that you applied to also?
Yeah, it turns out it's quite difficult to get hired as a foreigner at JPL, especially if you've got very low experience and no engineering degree all the other problems that I have.
That's the thing about JPL that I think a lot of people don't realize is it's something, and I mean, don't quote me on this, but it's something like one scientist to every like 10 engineers there. So the science team is actually like incredibly selective and they're legacy scientists. They've been there for many years. They probably had to collaborate first with their own labs and then eventually move over.
Yeah, it's not trivial.
Not that it's easy to get in as an engineer either. I mean, it's the best of the best. It's NASA and it's also the place where you make space robots. It's like that's what they do at JPL is they send unmanned missions.
It's just absolutely incredible what they do there. Yeah. I mean, like the other NASA centers, I don't want to leave them out. They also do some pretty cool missions, like the recent Pluto mission was not JPL.
Yeah.
But it's worth remembering, especially with regards to Mars, that, you know, like Russia, which launches a lot of rockets, Japan, European Space Agency, they've all had cracks at Mars. Mm-hmm. And only NASA has managed to land a working probe on the surface and only NASA's managed to land rovers on the surface.
And they've done it over and over and over.
And now they've done it. Now they've done it quite a few times.
And hasn't Russia tried to just get to Mars like 6 times now?
Russia hasn't had a functioning deep space mission in 20 years. But
who am I thinking of?
Russia.
I mean, yeah, it is.
Failing.
That's what you mean by not
It's really hard.
I would say a functioning deep space mission is having the tools to at least attempt it, no?
Well, they do. Phobos Grunt was the recent
mission. Exactly, that was the most recent one, and it ended up in the Pacific Ocean.
It did. A big chunk of plutonium, which annoys me, not because the plutonium will poison a fish. It won't. It's fine. It's encased, and it'll sink to the bottom and sink.
It's just important stuff.
There's a really big shortage of plutonium, and we need that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's important. It's expensive, and it does a lot of good stuff.
There's almost none of it left.
Yeah.
And you have deep space missions out to the outer planets.
But wasn't Phobos Grunt like number 6 for Russia or something? Like, maybe number 5. It was. Yeah. They've tried a lot.
They've tried a lot.
Yeah. And we've got just as many hits, really. Like
NASA still has failures, but
Curiosity, what is that, the 5th rover on Mars?
Fourth.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not good at these numbers. See, that's why you're the physicist.
But I live and breathe this stuff.
That's true. You know quite a bit, like I was saying. You were like, I don't work on LIGO, but you like describe the specs. Do you have like a LIGO map on your wall or something?
It's in my brain.
Gotcha.
I mean,
like a fanboy.
It's worth knowing a little bit about it when like the PI behind LIGO is on your thesis committee.
True. And also when the research that you do, even though you don't do that specifically, feeds right into that research, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's so allied.
Yeah. And especially like if you've got friends that are coming out from Australia to visit you, you can be like, here's my office and there's where I program C++. And they're like, wow, that looks completely different to my office in Australia where I program C++. And I'm like, okay, smartass, let's go look at the LIGO lab. We'll have a look at a mirror that's polished to within a smoothness of you know, a couple of atoms. And they're like, okay, you know, it seems all right.
It's pretty cool, I guess.
Whatever. I'm like, oh, look, there's the telescope where they discovered other galaxies. And they're like, yeah, whatever. look, here's where Carl Anderson discovered antimatter. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, okay. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty cool, yeah. actually, I really like that. Australia's a long way away. Don't get me wrong. It's like 14 hours by plane.
The worst flight ever. How often have you made it?
Well, soon, hopefully, I will make it again. Right now, I don't have the option.
Can you add up all of your... did you just come here once and that's it, or have you gone home to visit?
I've been home three times, I think, since
three
I came
times.
Out.
Three times. Yeah. So that's six of those flights.
Yeah, plus the ones when I came out first time and then like two or three other trips to the United States.
8, 9, 10, 11 of the... I've done it once.
I'm a pro at it now. Like,
I've done it once.
You stay up, you watch three movies, and then you sleep for 6 hours and you arrive at 6 a.m. in Australia and you feel great. Your family picks you up. By like 3 p.m., they're out because they got up really early to pick you up. But you're going strong. You go for a quick walk just to like avoid the post-prandial, like post-lunch snooze.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like back on again. And like by 10 p.m., you're like, okay, right, I'm going to like code up all my next paper. And your family's like, oh God, just go to sleep.
So you don't sleep on the flight?
No, I sleep. I sleep like 6 hours just before I arrive.
Gotcha. And then, but you watch three movies, then you sleep.
Then you're not too badly jet lagged either because mm-hmm. it's only a 6 hour time difference.
It's
but,
pretty bad. Yeah, it's like it's 6 hours on the wrong day.
Look, some people, Cara, do this all the time, so they're used to it.
I don't know how they do it. I don't know. I did it one time. It was horrible. And when I got to Australia, how many time zones are there in Australia?
Three.
Because when I got there, I went just basically across the country in what? Like
a couple of hours.
Like 6 days, maybe.
Okay.
It was a short trip. It was less than a week.
Okay.
So I got there and I went to like five cities in 6 days.
Oh, nice.
And then came back. So
why did you do that?
Because I was dating people somebody always, and they were on tour.
Okay. People always tell me, you know... oh, I'm going to Australia for like 6 days and I want to see like Melbourne, Sydney,
yeah.
Brisbane, Uluru, the Great Barrier Reef and like the Three Sisters and Tasmania as well and maybe down to Antarctica. And I'm like, whoa.
No, it's hard. I mean, I was the Walking Dead the whole time I was there.
They assume that you can drive from Sydney to Melbourne in like 2 hours. It's not. People drive slowly in Australia. It's like 12 hours. You have to take it. I mean, like if you're going for 6 days, that's a bit silly. And they're like, oh yeah, can we see New Zealand as well? I'm like,
No.
Like pick two places. If you're going for 4 weeks, pick four places.
Yeah.
You know, and just settle in and enjoy it.
I just had to look at it like, I mean, it was a day in each city. What yeah. I noticed though, is that Australia and Texas are very similar. Is that a weird thing to say? Have you visited Texas yet?
I've been there briefly. George W. Bush actually said the same thing when
really?
He came and visited. Yeah.
I feel like the people, there's like a friendliness, but kind of a southern, I don't know. It's a little bit redneck, but it's a little, it's.
We don't have any guns.
Yeah,
and
that's
not
true.
Not as many big trucks.
You don't have guns at all.
We don't pump oil in our backyard.
Yeah, but I don't think that I associate those things with my Texas. They do exist, but that culturally wasn't anything I was into, so I tried to put it on the back burner.
Yeah.
But it's definitely like mining country. It's a very kind of engineering, salt of the earth people. And I don't know, it just feels similar in that way. And the food's very similar. All about barbecue.
Yeah.
It's and hot as fuck.
Barbecued wombat.
Barbecued wombat. I held a wombat.
Cool. Did you barbecue it?
No. She was very sweet and stinky. She was huge. They called her Bubba or Big Mama or something like that.
Yeah.
It was like at a wildlife center
wombats
in Perth.
Wombats are quite terrifying.
Oh, this one was cute because she was like so fat she couldn't move.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay. Hyperloop.
Hyperloop. Okay. Yeah. So I left academia and it became obvious, about halfway through my postdoc a couple of months ago that the NASA option was not going to pan out in time for my immigration requirements.
Gotcha.
I can't be out of work for too long or they'll deport me. Like, we just spent like a whole bunch of money, American taxpayers' money, educating this foreigner and they want to work here and like improve the wealth of our country, but they can't find a job straight away. So we'll deport them and force them to work overseas.
Yeah,
that
brilliant.
Makes total sense.
Oh my God.
And so I was kind of typing into Google, like, what does a physicist do? Because I don't get me wrong, like finance is extremely important, but I didn't really want to work in finance straight away. And I didn't really want to go and work for my like friend's startup somewhere. I'm not arrogant about it. I need to eat, but
also need to love your work.
Yeah. I wanted to work on something with some social utility and, or space robots. I guess that has social utility.
That has a lot of social utility.
So I was kind of looking around and I did a coding test with Google and they're like, thanks, but no thanks. And now my friends who are Googlers think it's hilarious to like refer my resume as often as possible just so I keep getting rejection letters from them.
Wait. Somebody with a PhD who solved a problem that they'd been working on for 20 years, yeah. coding something that I still don't understand with regards to gravitational waves yeah. and black holes,
yeah.
can't get a job at Google?
I probably could if I took a little bit more time to understand what a database is. The sort of coding I was doing is very different to the sort of stuff they want a new person to step into and solve.
Okay.
Which is fair enough. I understand. They're a big company. They've commodified their labor force effectively.
But it does seem like they have entry-level jobs, no?
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway. So I was looking around and a friend of mine, there's a thing called Ephemeral, which is like Burning Man, but on the Sacramento River Delta, and you build... like houseboats, and then you build platforms and stuff like that. It's called Ephemeral. My friends call it Drowning Man because it's like wet. And I went and like helped build that because like when it comes to like giant raves in the desert, I'm much more down for the building than the taking drugs and dancing part of it.
Sure.
Call me a square, but you know, maybe when I'm old and weird, then I'll be more the other way. So I went along to Ephemeral and helped build and then left, went back to work. And then I wanted to see what happened when it was finished. So I took a friend of mine who's also getting a pilot's license, and we flew up to the Delta to fly over and have a look and land, and then go out and by ferry and have a look around.
Fun.
And then come back. And then she's like, oh, that was super cool. Here, you should talk to my friend X about something, and my friend Y about something, and my friend Z, that's American for Z, about Hyperloop. And I was like, Hyperloop is an actual thing that actual people are doing? She's like, yeah, it's based in downtown and you should totally talk. So I did. And here's a funny thing. So at grad school, some grad students work only on their project all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those grad students. I am someone who works on a whole bunch of different things all at the same time, most of them not related to my work.
Like flying.
Ostensibly, like flying or, mm-hmm. or 3D printing or whatever. Mm-hmm. But often that kind of relates back. Like a lot of the problems that I solved in my PhD, originally I solved in a different context, thinking, oh, I'm procrastinating. This is going to be so much fun. And then, oh, crap, I can apply this to my research. Now it seems legitimate in hindsight. Oh, no, what have I done?
Yeah, I still want to continue.
Yeah, so one of the things I did is a great thing you should try out for if you're a physicist is the Prospects in Theoretical Physics Summer School at Princeton at the IES. And you basically apply and you answer their questions and write an essay that sounds convincing, and they'll bring you on board for 2 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. And it's this incredible series of lectures by like the leading lights of a field that you're not actually in.
Gotcha.
And you learn so much. So I did it once and we were doing like string theory stuff, which blew my mind. And then the following year I also did it again. It was more like biophysics.
Okay.
And there were some people who came along who were talking about like genetic algorithms and classification problems and viruses and all kinds of stuff like that, which is this thing where like people who take the physics kind of mindset of like simplifying everything and then try and apply it to other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, genetic algorithms sound cool. So I decided I wanted to code up a genetic algorithm. And I did, like, just, like, really badly. And then I was like, now I have a solution. I need a problem. You know, I have this hammer. Everything looks like a nail. And about the same time, Elon Musk released the Hyperloop Alpha White paper. And I read through it, like, 2 seconds after it was released. And I was like, oh, pretty cool. You know. And
so for anybody listening, what is that?
Okay, so it's a piece of paper. Uh-huh. So Hyperloop, Hyperloop is a proposed fifth mode of transportation to connect 2 points. You know, not too far apart, not too close together, you know, Goldilocks principle. And the idea is you want a train that moves super quickly. Now, if you move a train super quickly on ordinary tracks, the tracks would be very smooth and the wheels break. So you say, we'll take the wheels out and replace it with an air bearing, which is a bit like a hovercraft, but it's used on a smooth surface, factories and things.
And magnified?
Not magnets, no. Just okay. Air bearing. So you basically, it's like an air hockey table.
Mm-hmm.
And then you move that down and then, so it's flying along, but if you want to go really, really fast, air resistance is a problem. So you put it inside a tube and suck out most of the air, not all of it, just enough so it's like the surface of Mars.
It's like almost a vacuum.
Yeah, like 1,000 times less air, something like mm-hmm. that. So you can actually do that with a single stage pump. It's not too difficult. Getting like a super, super, super duper vacuum like in LIGO is mm-hmm. really a pain in the ass. You don't want to have doors in that, for instance.
Yeah.
And then... which you would need to get people in and out.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. And also you don't want their heads to explode.
Let's not have their heads explode. Yeah, but you have a pressurized container in there. Like the pod is like an airplane. It's pressurized.
But what happens
like
if you lose pressure?
Well, I mean, the same thing happens if your airplane loses pressure.
Sure, but you get the little funny duck mask.
This is...
And then everything's okay. Yeah. put it on yourself before you put it on the child.
This is a solved problem. I mean, that's actually... That's easy enough to solve. Keeping everything pressurized. And the initial version is probably for cargo anyway, because mm-hmm. they'll probably go around corners too quickly.
So this is basically like a transportation method that yeah. looks like those old school tube things that you would go to the bank?
A little bit. Those ones, actually, they move the tubes inside them by suction. Gotcha. And that would not work in this instance because the pipe is so long, contains so much air. The mass, even when you suck most of the air out, the mass of the air is so much greater than the mass of the pod that if you're trying to move that mass of air around using vacuum cleaner or whatever, or a compressor or a turbine or whatever the fancy people call it, it'll generate drag against the edges of the tube and you'll be left with the same problem you had in the first place, which is that you've got drag of air against the surface.
So it's just a very expensive thing that doesn't work that well.
Yeah, yeah. So instead you accelerate the pod inside with a electromagnets, like a rail gun or like a theme park ride or something like that, like a drill basically, but flat. And then you have a turbine in the front to suck the air in the front and blow it out the air bearings to keep it hovering. And it just kind of coasts down the tube and you can go from say Los Angeles to San Francisco in 35 minutes, which would be super cool. Or say from Sydney to Melbourne in an hour, which would also be cool.
So how much faster than the bullet train would that be?
It's like point to point, probably two or three times faster.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and the bullet train in Japan is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
I sometimes have dreams about it.
You're such a nerd, not that kind of dream. Don't lie.
Sometimes that kind of dream. The train went into the tunnel and Mount Fuji exploded. So Cara will be right back.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah, so I was looking at this problem. I was like, that's super cool. But one of the parts of the paper that didn't convince me very much was where they're like, yeah, we'll just slow down a whole bunch to go through the Grapevine, which for non-Los Angeles locals is the road that goes from the Central Valley into the Los Angeles Basin. The Los Angeles Basin is surrounded by like really gnarly mountains and getting roads through them is hard work. Getting trains through them is nearly impossible. And getting a high-speed train through it where you can't turn with a radius less than, say, 15 miles is like what? You have to dig a lot of tunnels. Now, in the original Hyperloop white paper, the price quoted for tunnels is so cheap, unrealistically cheap, sorry, Elon, that that you could actually just dig a tunnel all the way from Los Angeles to San Francisco and it wouldn't be that expensive. But in the real world, tunnels cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
So you want to minimize the amount of tunnels and you also want to like minimize the amount of bridges and you don't want to have towers that are too high and all that kind of stuff. But obviously digging a tunnel that's 50 meters deep is a lot easier than making a bridge that's 5 miles long. And all that kind of stuff. And then also you can't turn too quickly and all that kind of thing. So you've got all these different constraints. And then you just know you've got to get like a tube, basically a line, if you like, a shape, a curve from one point to another point on either side of the mountains. And I'm like, hey, presto, this looks like a really good problem for a genetic algorithm. And I can go into the details for how genetic algorithms work, but basically it's okay, relax. You just put in... You find a way to specify a curve in a very, what I call, sparse manner with just a few numbers. And then you generate a whole bunch of randomly generated curves and then you have them breed with each other, which is the fun part. And then gradually over hundreds of generations, the winning curves come out the bottom according to a cost function or a fitness function that you generate that says, well, I don't want too many bridges. I don't want too many tunnels. I don't want to go around curves so sharply that I'm going to pull 400 Gs and kill everyone.
So you're putting Darwinian pressure on...
You got it.
...tunnels.
Yeah. And then I finished this and it actually worked, unlike most of my side projects, which go nowhere. And my brother, who's a surgeon in Australia, was like, you know, the key is just to publish all the time. Doesn't matter what it is. You just got to write a paper every week. just like anything, the most interesting thing you did that week, publish it. Doesn't matter what it is. You know, he's a surgeon. So like I cut open a patient and I found a Smurf inside, like publish that, you know, like whatever it is. And then you start getting invited to conferences and this is how you make a career. And I'm like, sounds good to me.
Your brother's a genius, by the way.
He is.
I mean, how many publications does he have?
I don't know, but he saved lots of lives, so that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, fine. So he poked the bottom of me a few times. Shout out to my brother. Thank you very much. I basically put together this paper, put it on the archive, which is where physicists and also crackpots put lots of papers.
This is like that ArxiV.
Yeah, ArxiV. ArxiV.org. And generally speaking, like once you put a crackpot paper on the archive, your career is done. So I posted on Twitter. I posted on Facebook. I was like, haha, my crackpot paper. Lol. I'm leaving academia forever. Lol. And here's my crackpot paper on Hyperloop genetic algorithm optimization. And I was also kind of hoping that a few people would notice it, which they did, and maybe give me a job or maybe like put in a good word with Elon and you can hire me at make rockets for SpaceX, which incidentally I'm not allowed to do because I'm a dirty foreigner and I'm going to steal all your rocket secrets and like sell them to North Korea, apparently.
Seriously? But that's the rules. You can't make rockets?
I can't make rockets.
I can't
actually make weapons because like...
Can you make rocket fuel?
No. Anything that's like considered advanced weapons technology, I'm not allowed to work on without like miles of paperwork.
So you probably couldn't even work in like a nuclear power plant.
Once I get a green card, it's fine. Once I get a green card, I'm instantly trustworthy. So
are you doing that? Are you working on that?
Yeah, that's going to happen soon, hopefully.
So you don't...
If my officer is listening to this podcast, I'm totally not selling secrets to North Korea.
You do plan on staying here and working here. That's the goal.
Yeah, that's my intention. Yeah, gotcha. I want to stay in Los Angeles and work on Hyperloop. And anyway, so I talked to this fellow who my friend put me in contact with at a cafeteria in downtown LA about Hyperloop stuff. And basically, it was one of those, like, if you've ever done like online dating, you're kind of trying to size someone up. It was a bit like that, less overt sex, I guess, but certainly a lot of like, so, you know, how much physics do you have? And so basically like rattling off the problems I knew that were in the white paper, including the tunnel costing problem and the heat disposal problem and a few other problems.
And this is somebody that you're... your drowning man friend. This is human Zed, for example.
This is human Zed. This is human Zed. And, you know, we're talking for hours and hours. I'm like, this is going well. So I thought maybe he'll invite me back to his place, which is the office just down the road. And he did. And I was like, wow, this is super cool. There's like heaps of people here and they're actually making an actual Hyperloop. And wow.
And are they doing it for Elon Musk or is it a totally different company?
So actually a lot of the founders and people like senior engineers are ex-SpaceXers. These are people who like built the first generation SpaceX rockets.
Yeah.
And then found themselves drowning in paperwork and were like, let's go and like these are people who are like sufficiently maladjusted that they don't really want to work in giant companies. They always want to be at the bleeding edge, you know, just 1 week away from starvation, and that's the way they like it, which is fine by me. So I went in there and I talked to a whole bunch of people, and it turns out I'm the world expert in genetic algorithm Hyperloop route optimization.
Because you invented the field.
Because I invented it. So they're like, yeah, would you like to start? And I'm like, cool. Okay.
Do you have genetic algorithm Hyperloop hybridization like groupies? Do you have people who want to like, who now are studying the work, quote unquote, that you've done and are like reaching out to you saying, how do I optimize this, professor?
Well, currently there's only two Hyperloop companies. But people who mainly reached out were like, can I borrow your data because I want to use it in my visualization scheme?
Cool.
Not can I borrow your method, which I guess is interesting because the method is the interesting part to me, that visualization is after the fact. Mm. But you know, whatever. I mean, like curves that run through mountains are fine by me. And I'm also, I fly planes occasionally because grad school was so lucrative. I'm like, I should get my pilot's license. And so every now and then I'm flying over these same passes because when you fly a cheap, slow plane, you don't want to fly over the tall mountains. And so I take heaps of photos and then I can take these photos and like kind of draw on them like, oh, that's where the Hyperloop would go.
I love that. And you probably also do get being up in the air, you know, even if you're not up that high, is such a different
I can go high enough to like suffocate.
You can, which is, I'm very impressed, Casey.
Yeah, I don't want to, but I can.
No, but being sufficiently high that the world looks different, you know what I mean? We're used to looking at the world through specific planes, and the minute you change that plane, it's kind of like it forces you to think outside of the box.
Unintended.
I didn't. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Actually, it's spelled the same too. God damn it.
Yeah. It's we were looking at the plane from the plane, and it changed
the plane
of our existence.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the... it absolutely does. And flying around Los Angeles is just, I feel so privileged every time I do it.
It's stunning. Los Angeles is such a weird area.
Even 5 years ago, I would never have dreamed that I just like whenever the hell I wanted, go to the plane and fly at places.
Do you fly at night in LA?
Yeah.
It's beautiful at night.
It's gorgeous. So like last Wednesday, for instance, a friend of mine was like, oh, let's fly up to Bishop and we'll rent a car and then hike around in the Sierras and then fly back in one day. And
that's so
I'd
cool.
got back from Burning Man the previous day and I was like, that's a really bad idea, not because I'll probably crash and die, but because when I do, the newspaper headlines will be like, idiot, ex-Burning Man, blah, 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 crash into mountain, died.
Burner dies.
Yeah, and this guy's like a new dad as well. So like, I was like, let's not tempt fate. There's a bad bushfire smoke up there at the moment. So we decided to fly to Catalina Island instead and then just do a really short hike from the airport down to the beach.
Oh, fun.
Which incidentally nearly killed us because it was hot and insanely steep. But at least we didn't die flying, which is where the headlines come in.
How long have you been flying?
I've got about 160 hours now, which is...
So can you fly in fog? Not yet.
I shouldn't.
I was wondering, I know that I just random
I'm a
aside,
VFR pilot, which means I fly in clear skies. Yeah,
gotcha.
Clear weather.
Yes. I knew that there was some sort of cutoff there. I flew for a show that I did. Which show was this on?
Yeah. I want to take Derek up and show him weightlessness.
Can't do that.
I can totally do that.
You can do parabolic flights?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
cool. Yeah, I want to do
skydivers it. Skydivers can do parabolic flights, kind of.
I kind of want to do it.
It's a lot of fun. I always give my passengers the option and they almost always opt in and they almost always are like, holy moly, that was the coolest thing ever.
Do they take anything beforehand?
No.
Has anybody ever puked in your plane?
Not from that.
Really?
Yeah.
Because people puke all the time in the vomit comet.
Yes. Well, it's a bit different in my plane because you only do it for a few seconds at a time.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is...
Well, vomit comet's only 8 seconds, right?
Up to 30.
Oh,
I'll do Mars gravity or moon gravity or something just first. And that's really cool because you can like hold your phone in your hand and like just throw it around. And people are used to throwing keys or phones or whatever, but then suddenly it's like it's moving really slowly and just kind of bouncing off the ceiling and bouncing off the walls and they don't even have time to feel sick.
This is embarrassing. I rode this ride at Disney World. I've talked about this before on the podcast.
In Orlando.
Called Mission Earth, I think is what it's called. I'm looking it up to make sure. And people have like died on Mission Earth, so I kind of feel like I'm not as big
people
of a
people have died
pussy.
In grad school.
Yeah, that is true.
Not even once.
Maybe it's not even called Mission Earth. Maybe it's called Mission Mars. I don't remember. Anyway, the way that it... Mission Space. And now they have like a less intense version of the ride, but when I first rode it was the year that it opened, and it's basically just a sim, but the way that the sim works is that you're in a giant centrifuge, so you like push G's.
Oh, awesome.
And I had that moment of, and I didn't lose consciousness, but I had that moment of like starting to have tunnel vision.
Yeah.
And I remember telling myself like, don't lose consciousness. Don't lose consciousness.
How many G's were you pulling?
I don't know. I'm going to look.
I think 3 G's is about the max for those rides.
Mission Space. I mean, it was pretty like, I feel like 2 or 3 people died on it because they had like heart conditions that they didn't know about. It. Mission Space. G's. Let's see. Yeah. Orange G's.
I mean, like pulling, you can pull positive G's in planes as well. Mm-hmm. If you pull enough G's, you'll stall or spin or break the wings off. But negative G's, reduced G's are a lot of fun.
2.5 G's.
Yeah, that sounds
sustained.
Like, that sounds like fun. That's like 1.5 people sitting on you.
It says the key here is sustained G forces on a roller coaster like Rock and Roller Coaster. You may pull around 4 to 5, but only for a fraction of a second. But this one's 2.5 G's sustained. And like I was literally like, I'm gonna lose consciousness. And they have barf bags in it and stuff. So anyway, I'm not sure if I could do parabolic flights.
Well, we'll give it a go someday.
Okay, maybe.
Crystal did it.
Crazy, Crystal?
Yeah, Crystal and Holly.
Was she wearing high heels?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I insisted on wearing shoes with which you could rapidly egress the plane if necessary.
Good.
Yeah,
good.
I wear my sandals for when flying, you know.
And Holly did it too. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Holly was in the same plane. We went up for Crystal's birthday, I think.
Oh, that's fun.
No, hang on. We went up for Holly's birthday and Crystal was in the
back. Neither of them felt sick?
No.
Okay.
No.
Maybe I'll do it.
Yeah, it was a smooth day. I mean, like if it's a really bumpy day, I normally wouldn't do it unless it's with someone I've done it before.
Yeah.
If I go up with other pilots, anything goes.
You'll do crazy shit.
Because you just get used to it.
I was going
to
say
I took Tegan up the other day.
I know.
Yeah.
You took her, you were our, what do you call it? Our patsy? That's not a thing.
I don't know what a patsy is.
Yeah. I feel like you were like the
I think you're like the last person I haven't taken up yet.
You might be,
actually.
That and
Derek, yeah.
The last person in the history of people. No, what's a patsy? Is that the right word? It's like you were the a person who was easily taken advantage of. No,
oh,
that wasn't you.
Yes.
That wasn't
me.
You, though.
That's totally me. Yes, for Tegan's surprise birthday party.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the person who, like, you took her out to...
Yeah, I tried to show her a really amazing time.
Yeah.
And then you guys all threw this giant... surprise birthday party, and now I'm pretty sure she doesn't even remember the flying.
She remembers the flying.
Okay, good.
And we all remember you guys getting there a fraction of a second before she got there. And
we saw her driving
in.
By as we were running in the front door, and we're like, if they saw us, it's for nothing. We've ruined everything. But they didn't, and we were okay.
No, she was so surprised she cried. I loved it. That was
I like making people cry.
I do too. In a good way.
In a good way.
In a positive way.
Definitely.
I was going to say, and now it's not even that interesting, but I did a show for... GE. I did a branded fun thing with GE and Vice called the Invention Factory, and one of the things that we did was go up flying. And I remember my director. It was my director, my camera person in the back seat. I was in the front seat, and then it was our pilot, and he was quite young. And I remember being like I'm kind of scared to go up in this little plane, and we're going to fly to Alcatraz. We flew from Palo Alto to Alcatraz and kind of came back around, like around the Golden Gate. It was really nice.
Oh, wow.
But we flew first time ever through SFO air traffic. So it was fucking crazy because he was like, I've never done this. And I was like, what the fuck? And then my director was like, ask him how old he is. I was like, no, don't do this to me. He was 20 years old.
That's so cute.
20 years old.
That's
I
fine.
Always shit myself. That's and that's when I learned that you can't fly in fog unless you have a certain number of hours.
Yeah. I mean, like I've considered getting my what's called instrument rating. And I think it'd be super cool. But mostly what I do with planes is fly friends around. And if the weather's bad, you don't want to fly your friends around because they're not going
to
enjoy sitting inside a cloud for hours on end and being told what to do by air traffic controllers for hours on end. It's something that pilots kind of like to do. And if I lived on the East Coast or something where it's cloudy all the time, then I'd have to do it sooner or later. But here in Los Angeles, I'm like, oh, it's cloudy today. Well, that's kind of neat. Let's go to the beach.
Exactly. Yeah.
Redhead.
Why do? Oh, I love it. You still get tan. Still got to wear that sunscreen.
A little bit. Little
it's
bit.
Important. Get a tan in the clouds. Okay, where were we? Hyperloop. Everything. We're running out of time, which is why I'm starting to get afraid. But you talk so fast, I don't think it matters. No, you have to pick up a friend from the airport.
I do,
and it's you've still got 10 minutes before you should leave, but I think that we should start winding things down a little bit, because I've still got to ask you the last two questions.
Yes.
But I don't want to do that yet. I want to make sure that there's nothing else we want to talk about.
Then,
what's another thing? We talked about flying, and we talked about Hyperloops, and we talked about space robots.
I mean, what's been in the news recently is the suggestion that we should nuke Mars. Did you read about that?
No.
Okay, so Stephen Colbert has a new show, apparently.
Yes.
I don't normally watch TV.
I have not actually watched him.
And his guests on the first day or something included ScarJo and Elon Musk in series, not parallel. and Stephen asked Elon, why do you want to go to Mars? It's kind of a bad, inhospitable place. And he's like, it's a fixer-upper of a planet. And then, well, you need to warm it up. And there's a couple of different ways of warming it up. And Elon suggested dropping nuclear bombs on the poles to outgas a lot of carbon dioxide and thicken up the atmosphere, which would then start a greenhouse effect and warm up the surface. It would melt water and
But how long would you have to wait for the fallout?
Well, he thinks it would take only a couple of years to warm the planet up enough. And the fallout wouldn't be a particularly big issue because Mars is already bathed in radioactive radiation from space.
I mean, are they kind of like six in one, half a dozen the other? It's still going, don't worry.
It's still going?
Yeah.
We'll cut out that awkward pause.
Hang on. By the way, if there are any weird glitches in the recording tonight, it's because at least three times now GarageBand has either told me that disk is too slow, which is helpful.
Yes.
Or it has asked me if
speaking
I
speaking too fast.
Yeah. It's your fault. Yeah. Or it's asked me if, because I record through my my Apogee Duet, it's asked me if I would like to use the device AirPlay instead. No, I don't want to fucking use AirPlay. I want to stick with my Duet. Sorry, GarageBand, you pissed me off. So there may be times where nobody notices anything and I sound like a crazy person, or there may be times where we're talking and then it goes, and then we come back.
Yeah.
Like two black holes. No, but that's boop.
Yeah, yeah, it's a chirp. It goes up in frequency, unless you're going back in time.
Anyway, the nuclear, like the radiation that you would be bombarded with just being on Mars.
Well, you wouldn't be on Mars at the time, presumably. This is something you might do in advance.
Of course.
Or you'd be in a different part of Mars. I don't think if you were going to Mars to live on Mars, you probably wouldn't live on the poles. But the really cool thing is you'd fly the nuclear bomb right over the pole, exploded at exactly the right second. All the radiation, like the gamma rays and the heat and so on, would go down into the atmosphere. Or something like half would go up, half it would go down. And melt a little bit of the surface, but then all the like radioactive byproducts would just continue coasting out through space and eventually be blown out of the solar system by the solar wind or whatever. Like,
but wouldn't some of the radioactive byproducts be in the stuff it's melting, be like caught up in the water
like
supply?
Neutrons or something, maybe. But I mean, like,
but
the surface of Mars is
sick.
Already like bombarded by the solar wind.
Because either way, we're gonna have to wear like crazy spacesuits or build like a big bubble.
But
kind
I mean, don't
community.
Forget, we like blew up 1,000 nuclear bombs on the surface of Earth in
That's
the
1950s, true.
And like
it wasn't 1,000.
Yeah, about 1,000 in total.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
And it didn't cause overwhelming problems.
Because the
way.
Fallout is usually like confined to a specific area.
I mean, like a number of people in Nevada and some fishing boats and so on in the Pacific got what I'd call acute dosages of fallout and died or got very ill. But kind of it all spread out and dissipated and caused mutations in our children.
Yeah, exactly.
Twitch, twitch, twitch.
Yes. But like you couldn't go to the poles for, you know, tens of thousands of years.
No, I think
that
would
right?
be a problem.
It's really?
It's a very large surface area. The surface area of Mars is the same as the surface area of land on Earth.
Okay.
But the key takeaway is, I was thinking about this today because maybe Kara will ask me about it, or maybe I'll just find a way of introducing it. And I should probably know the number off the top of my head.
Sneaky.
You'd probably need about 10,000 of the largest nuclear warheads per year for like 5 years to do it. And we don't have that many nuclear warheads on Earth.
We're trying to do disarmament right now.
Yeah.
We're trying to count down.
Yeah. We have like enough to kind of make a dent in it, but not enough to complete the job.
I mean, it could be a cool way to disarm the Earth.
Well, it also require a lot of rockets.
It would. A lot.
A lot.
And we probably need nuclear fuel.
For like reactors and stuff here on Earth?
No, like to get the rockets to Mars. Like, don't you think?
Well, some people think that nuclear rockets are a good idea. I don't think they're necessary to get to Mars.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can make do with standard. Like, the rocket that took astronauts to the moon is, like, nearly enough to go to Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did they use in The Martian? Do you remember? They use some sort of weird...
Actually, so we were talking about The Martian. Mm-hmm. Some friends of mine and I were reading it and...
so good.
And I made a copy of this 3D printed ring that I have. My friends will know it's a 3D printed, the surface of Mars is a ring.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave it to Andy Weir, the author. And then I was like, oh, and by the way, do you mind if I like write a technical commentary of The Martian and publish it? And he's like, no, whatever. So...
Did he think that was like super badass?
Yeah, he thought it was incredibly
badass.
He really
liked it, right?
Although I did note Buzz Aldrin tweeted a picture of him and Andy Weir and he wasn't wearing it. So I'm super upset. No, it's fine. It's fine. but it's really cool because, you know, between me and half a dozen of my friends or so, we like know a lot of stuff about space.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to go through the text of the novel, which I obtained somehow. And, it's actually available free on the internet and no, like officially.
Or you can buy it from Amazon. What do you mean?
I mean, like it was originally released for free on the internet. That's how he published it.
You're right.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right.
And we went through it in a Google Doc and like made hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of corrections all the way through of all the stuff that was wrong.
I heard about this and he actually fixed a lot of them before the next publication,
yes.
Right?
Well, there's still a couple of problems, fortunately for us and us other nitpickers who get off on that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But the really nice thing is, and I don't really know what the movie is going to do with this stuff. I know they've changed a lot of stuff, but the problems that exist there are like very excusable. Like they're not like even by the standards of high sci-fi, they're like really small problems.
They're like poetic license problems,
yeah, exactly.
Right? They're like if we didn't
you need
do this
problem
story would
for the
work.
Plot to exist.
Exactly.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Is the point.
It's a deus ex machina. Like you need this otherwise. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could come up with some other excuse, but this actually motivates it. Like, dust storms aren't that bad, or like radio beacons aren't that hard to fix.
Yeah.
Or, you know, didn't the Hab depressurize? Wouldn't all the laptops have died? Stuff like that. But like,
gotcha.
There's no big deal.
But he did, I mean, I do feel like he did such a good job of making the science service the plot and the plot service the science. And
yeah, and the whole thing bounces along. I mean, like, it kind of delves down in potatoes in about chapter six. But aside from that,
I like the potato chapter.
I'm kind of Irish, so I'm like, diddly-dee potatoes. Yeah. But
it was like comic relief. I felt like there was some good comic relief.
Yeah,
in
it
the
was great.
Chapter.
And the whole thing bounces along, and it's told really well. And the nice thing is that talking about the science and whether that's a mistake or not a mistake is actually subservient to the greater point, which is that we can actually use this as a vehicle to talk about like a lot of the technology in a much more detailed sense, which is something that hopefully I'll work on in my copious free time between now and never.
I love it.
Yeah. So that's.
Are really you going to see the movie?
Oh, am I going to see the movie?
Yeah.
Of course.
Good.
I'll probably turn up in a spacesuit. You know.
Are you going to be sad though if they make it like sappy? Because I already saw that they give him a wife and kids.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
But other than that, so because you never know when you watch a movie trailer, you're like, oh God, is it going to be cheesy? Because they're showing all the high points.
I know it's going to be cheesy because like the interior shots they've got at NASA look amazing. And if you've ever been to NASA, it's like, this is a government. It's a government agency.
It looks like the post office.
It's a government agency. Exactly. Like they built the building and they vacuum it and that's it.
Yeah.
Like,
but other than that, there have been a couple of reviews, like Hollywood Reporter just recently did a review that basically say, first of all, that's phenomenal.
Okay.
That it's very true to the book.
Almost always on point. So
he is, except he's a bit religious for my taste.
Prometheus.
He's a bit into like the obelisk and you touch it and then you know everything and there's a creator. He likes creation myths with
the obelisk is a yeah.
Yeah. But he they said it's very true to the book and the science is the star of the movie, which to me is great to hear
kind
in a review.
Like,
so
Interstellar in that sense.
Yeah, which is exciting. So there's that.
Okay,
and
cool.
We're running low on time, so I'm just going to...
No.
I love this. We've been bouncing around like crazy. I'm going to ask you the two questions that I ask everybody. So the first one is, when you look to the future, what is the thing that most concerns you, that keeps you up the most at night? And on the flip side of that, when you look to the future, what are you most optimistic about?
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to answer them both at the same time.
Okay, I like it.
Which is that, you know, we're actually at a very interesting time right now where the decisions that our leaders make in the next few years will really have a huge role in what happens to our children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren, should we wish to produce them. And the reason for that is, you know, if we can transition to sustainable energy production in the next decade, then low-lying countries and farming land has a chance. But the good news is that we're actually kind of almost sort of seem to be getting there. Even just on economic merits, it hasn't, you know, like the legalistic stuff is lagging, but in terms of deployments of solar panels, it is doubling at the appropriate rate. And if we can keep doubling at that rate for the next 10 years, then we'll be there. That'll be good. And the other thing I like to think about is it doesn't really matter what I do right now. In 150 years, everyone I know will be dead and mostly forgotten, which sounds a little bit bleak, but I guess what that really means is like what you need to do is contribute in some way to our cultural store of memes and whatever, and our industrial capacity, such that our descendants, the people who'll be doing stuff then, have something to work on, you know, if that makes any sense. And I think that's like the really exciting thing about education and about legacy is realizing that actually your time here, well, it's a lot of fun, but it's a very, very brief time really on the surface of the earth, the atoms that you borrow for a couple of years at a time. So that's my view on the future. Is that specific enough for you?
It is, it is. And you know, it's interesting because it definitely seems like we forget sometimes that as much as we feel like we are at the cutting edge, we're in the technology revolution, we're in the computer age, we're in all of these things. Really, like you just said, what we do now with our time is laying the foundation for what future generations will do.
Yeah.
We will always feel like we're really behind, or we will always seem to them like we were really behind, but like we laid this really strong foundation for them.
Or not, depending, you know.
Yeah, depending on how much we slack. Not you, Casey. You're not a slacker.
Oh, in my better days.
Well, soon hopefully we'll have you to thank for the Hyperloop.
Yeah, well, hopefully that works.
Time will tell. All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I want you to let everybody know before you leave where they can say hello. I don't know if you're on Twitter or if you're on Facebook or if you like to stay away from the social media. And also earlier you did say, email us if you're a coder. Was that a joke?
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, if you feel a burning desire to get in touch, I can be found via my website, caseyhanmer.com. I do have a Twitter, but I don't tweet. But if you think you're hilarious, then maybe I'll follow you. And I have a Facebook as well. Casey Hanmer is a unique string that maps to me.
Love it. All right. Well, Casey, thank you so much for joining me and everybody else for tuning in. I look forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.